You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
PRI's Studio 360 is made possible in part by a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Maps begin by staking out someone's property.
They are objects for the imagination, not for mathematical calculation.
They are using those sounds as a way of guiding themselves.
This is Studio 360. This is you. From WNYC in New York and Public Radio International, I'm Kurt Anderson. Today, an artist creates a map of her neighborhood using sound.
As sounds happen, the world sort of comes into being from that location.
And a 16th century cartographer slaps a name on that weird new continent over there to the left.
Up to this point in time, it was understood the world was set. It's an incredible change taking place on this particular map.
With me to talk about the cultural power and meaning of maps is Simon Schama, the historian and author of Landscape and Memory and A New History of Britain. That's all ahead in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. First, I wanted to talk about a story out of Washington that you might have missed, given everything else that's been going on lately. In October, the Supreme Court heard arguments involving a 1996 federal law intended to crack down on a new form of child pornography, which on the face of it sounds simple and uncontroversial. Pornography involving children is repugnant. The children are victims, and the monsters who make and traffic in it are criminals. But like all attempts to circumscribe free expression, the Child Pornography Prevention Act is not simple at all, which is why a lower court declared it unconstitutional and why the Supreme Court is wrestling with it now. The law has two big free speech problems, a strange one that we've never encountered before and an old familiar one. The strange new problem, the one that inspired Congress to draft and pass the law, is that personal computers and common software can now be used to create astoundingly lifelike images of human beings. There are benign examples of this, like the recent PG-13 sci-fi movie Final Fantasy.
Every night, the same dream, the same strange planet. But why? What are they trying to tell me?
A cartoon that looks virtually real. But that same state-of-the-art technology can also be used to create astoundingly lifelike pornographic images of children. Child pornography has been illegal mainly because the children forced to appear in it are victims. But with these computer-generated pictures, the children don't exist. They are imaginary, for legal purposes, no different than any drawings, paintings, cartoons, or other fictions. So the difficult new question is this. Should we make this kind of smut illegal when no actual human children are involved in its creation? No matter how grotesque it is, how sick and twisted the people who make and watch it are, I don't think we want to criminalize it, to turn these purely imaginary creations into crimes. That would seem to me like a big, dangerous step down the slippery slope of censorship. As everyone from Voltaire to the ACLU has said a million times, I may despise what you're saying, but I'll defend to the death your right to say it. The other problem with the law is its broadness. Because the intention is to ban computer images that look real, it outlaws the depiction of anything that, quote, appears to be a minor engaging in sexually explicit conduct. Consider the unintended consequences of that. The creators of all sorts of art and legitimate entertainment could be indicted, convicted, and sent to prison for up to 30 years. At the Supreme Court hearing, the justices dealt with both of these difficult issues and with our competing essential needs to protect children as well as cultural freedom. Justice Antonin Scalia sarcastically asked a lawyer, what great works of art would be taken away from us if we couldn't see minors copulating? The lawyer paused, then mentioned Lolita. In the 1997 film of Nabokov's extraordinary novel starring Jeremy Irons, The actress who played Lolita was 15 years old.
But so what? Because you don't care about me anymore anyway.
Why do you think I don't care about you?
Well, you haven't kissed me yet, have you?
Justice Scalia responded, again sarcastically, a great work of art. Then the lawyer mentioned last year's Academy Award-winning film Traffic, starring Michael Douglas.
Yeah, what do you want?
I'm looking for my daughter, Caroline. She's been here.
This is a business, man.
I need to find my daughter, all right? I'll pay you.
Traffic seems unquestionably against the law. In one disturbing scene, Douglas's down-and-out runaway teenage daughter is shown apparently having sex with her cocaine dealer. Justice Scalia responded, with all due respect, this is not the Mona Lisa or the Venus de Milo. But Justice John Paul Stevens was ready with a comeback for his colleague. He asked, how about Romeo and Juliet? The Supreme Court will rule on the case by spring. This is Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. Later this month on PBS, a new film called The Art of Violin celebrates great violinists of the past. And a flood of recent CDs and other historical tributes are all pushing us toward an earlier age of musical performance. Sarah Fischko looks at the lure and the influence of a particular bygone musical era.
Classical music, recorded classical music, that is, had what is known as a golden age, and we seem to be in our own golden age of its revival. As technology and scholarship improve, we are surrounded by tantalizing reminders of great, now deceased musicians who tore through the standard repertoire 50, 60, 70 years ago. We're just beginning to see the first lavish releases from a website called Andante.com, complete with its own record label, with plans to release 60 historical CD sets a year. Arbiter and other small labels release scholarly editions of old recordings, a new film, and they all send essentially one message, that this was an era of freedom for the artist, freedom to be an eccentric personal performer, a freedom many feel has long since ended.
So many of these old recordings attest a freshness, a spontaneity that is no longer commonplace.
Alain Coblance is a lawyer, music lover, and founder of Andante.com.
The process of recording has become so demanding technically, the way the splicing takes place, practically taking away so much of the genuine inspiration of the interpreter.
Coblance and others are aiming to reintroduce this atmosphere of drama and risk-taking into the music-listening experience.
Performers took great chances when they performed because they didn't have the aura of permanence attached to each performance.
Jed Distler is a contemporary pianist and composer who studies and writes about the early days of recording, especially as it applies to pianists.
You know, if Vladimir Horowitz wanted to try something twice as fast and it worked, great. And if it didn't work well, got another concert. What's happened is because we're so inundated with records, we expect concerts almost to sound like records, and people find ways of playing so that they sound like records, which is a kind of very safe, uniform playing where the rhythm is very regular. There's this very square sense of how the music is to ensure safe edits.
It's almost as if recordings have out-edited themselves. There is a craving now for recordings with idiosyncrasies intact.
Violinists back then had this wonderful sense of not just a beautiful sound, but it was so natural what they did.
Violinist Sarah Chang turns 21 next week. As an even younger violinist, she played with Isaac Stern and Yehudi Menuhin.
Whenever I can get my hands on a live recording of something that somehow got passed through generations and generations, and somehow I got a copy of, I mean, it's truly magical because you think, my goodness, this is why they call it the Golden Age.
So maybe a young performer learns to listen a certain way, and maybe the old style even directly affects performance.
Just this kind of imagination, sound world that you get from a lot of these players is something that I've always tried to emulate in my own performances.
And perhaps there is something for the listener to learn, too, from the outpouring of newly discovered or remastered recordings from the Golden Age.
Certainly, it will educate the public and give them a testimony of what music sounded like when it was really free and authentic and spontaneous, and get us back to a time when going to a concert was an adventure and you weren't really sure what you would hear.
My personal favorite is Oistrakh playing the Brahms Concerto, and it's live and it is just the closest thing to perfection I've ever heard. I remember I listened to that CD when I was about 8 or 9, when I was learning the Brahms Concerto, and I put it away. And I put away the Brahms Concerto thinking, I better give myself a little more time. And then I only picked it up and played it in public for the very first time when I was 18. So I waited about 10 years before I went on stage with it. I was so influenced by that one recording, and it gave me something to strive for.
I think David Oistrakh said, I know I'll never sound as good as my records.
But that was a secret only he knew. For the rest of us, these recordings, films, and preservations of our musical history are our resources. Right now, it seems very much as if the music world is mining them for some eternal truths about performance that may help a fragile classical music business find its way. For Studio 360, I'm Sarah Fishkin.
PBS will broadcast The Art of Violin, celebrating the recorded legacy of some of the great violinists of the 20th century, on December 11th. You can find out more on our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, and it's time now for this week's cover story. I don't consider myself a collector. I am an occasional habitué of flea markets and galleries and auctions and antique shows and eBay, and every now and then I do buy things, but not with any collecting strategy or conscious obsession. But then, a few years ago, I realized that as often as not, the things I covet are maps. Literal microscale maps, like my 1862 map of a few blocks of New York's East Village neighborhood that is overlaid with the 17th century Dutch streets running at an angle to the modern streets, and maps at the grandest scale imaginable, like my dozen antique maps of the solar system and galaxies. So maybe I am obsessed. On driving vacations, I'm the designated navigator. So sometimes, passing down an idyllic Tuscan hillside or past some exquisite Irish beach, I have to be reminded by family members to look outside instead of staring down at my beloved Michelin roadmap. Now that I think about it, what were the most exciting and memorable pages of my books as a child? Why, the map of the Hundred Acre Wood in my Winnie the Pooh hardcovers, and the map of Middle Earth in my paperback of The Hobbit, and the maps of Gettysburg and Manassas in my books about the Civil War. We inhabit a civilization where maps have always been central as artful tools, as vistas of cultural identity and ambition, as expressions of our restlessness and hankering for adventure. So today in Studio 360, we'll be talking about maps, and my special guest and guide through this terrain is Simon Schama, the historian and cultural scholar who's written several breathtaking books, including Rembrandt's Eyes, Landscape and Memory, and most recently, his History of Britain. Simon, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you for having me.
I understand that you, like me, have had a long interest in, if not perhaps as unhealthfully as I, in maps.
Yes, I loved them as a kid, and I love them so much that I made them. I used to simply take out a sheet of white paper and start with always a kind of curvy line and then a wrinkled indented line. That would be a coast, and then I'd produce a bay. And what kids do when they make those first maps, or when they look at their first maps, is make a series of stories. I did a little bay because I wanted a pirate ship to be in there. I wanted a mountain because this was one in which my, you know, my child hero, moi, was going to get to the top of and spy, you know, some sort of snake pit or some perfect crock of gold below. And that was true, I think, when Europeans first started to do maps. They also moved from place to place, catching stories as they went, and they wanted to kind of plant something which said, this happened to me there, this happened to me here.
Well, in fact, A History of Britain, Volume 2, begins with your story of maps and a map maker.
Right. Maps seem to come before nations. There's a map maker called John Speed, who was a tailor, and one of his contemporaries said he stitched together England. He had 18 children, and he got incredibly interested in doing maps of counties. And this had been done before in the reign of Queen Elizabeth, but they were maps for gentlemen mostly. Queen Elizabeth's favorite counselor, William Cecil, Lord Burghley, had produced for him, done by a man called Christopher Saxton, the first pocket atlas, I think. I mean, he was the first politician, was Cecil, to, as it were, go on the road with the Queen and want to know, where the hell am I? And who are these people? And am I still in Shropshire?
And what John Speed did is create a sort of popular...
He did it for the people, yeah. Exactly. And the odd thing was he knew that, pockets, don't want pockets. What you want is a big production number, but done quite cheaply. But it would have to have sort of little men in it. You didn't want just roads and names. When you got to Cambridge, you had to have gussied up, as we say, with pictures of bearded professors. And you needed battles. And he actually was the first person to have tiny little munchkin-like people waving lances and spears and pikes at each other planted in the place where the Wars of the Roses had happened.
So what we regard as sort of the modern tourist map mode, he was really...
Entertainment. Yeah. Armchair travel and entertainment.
So it really was about stories.
It was still about stories, yes.
Is this interest in maps and this need for maps, do you think, a peculiarly Western thing? Or is it, do we just have it a sort of greater obsession with this depiction of reality than other cultures?
Well, it's a travel thing. And other cultures like, you know, the Arabs, really, in medieval Islam was incredibly restless, had great mariners. And in fact, we got our first sort of sailing chance, as I understand it, not being a great sailor, from the Arabs. We knew how to get from Africa to India because Vasco da Gama and Diogo, people like that, the Portuguese, pinched Arab navigators. So the Arabs at that point were very restless. But we've always been restless. I mean, our first great ripping yarn travel book is Herodotus. And Herodotus is not from Athens. He's from the islands. And that book, even though it's supposed to be about us, the Greeks, and the Persians, it's fantastically footloose. It wants to know, he goes to Egypt and he goes to Persia, and he wants to tell you that in Egypt, women pee standing up. Therefore, it's a very different place. But he also, by telling you about weird things that happen in Egypt and Persia, he makes them closer, not dangerously exotic. But they also have to, I think it's a thing about maps, Kurt, that actually, and with your 100-acre wood, there are maps which take you place by place and story by story, but then you want to know where the end is somehow. I mean, even if Western Lion's going to trail off into the ocean or kind of sort of mysterious, you want to be in literally that bird's-eyed view so you can actually have the whole world in the palm of your hand. There's something we crave to know that somehow.
I'm Kurt Anderson, talking today with the art scholar and historian Simon Shama. Coming up, we'll be talking about that moment that the known world sprouted a new continent. Stay with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson talking today to the historian Simon Shama, and we're talking about maps and art and the imagination. The first picture that many Europeans got of the New World was itself partly a work of imagination. In 1507, Martin Waldseemüller laid out the mysterious continent as a rag at the western fringe of the world. He called this previously untitled land America. The Library of Congress recently bought the only surviving copy of this huge map for $10 million. In our first story today by Andrea Murray of WETA, that map's conservators pieced together what the map meant to 16th century Europeans.
What we do here is treat rare materials and collections.
Map conservator Heather Wanzer works in a room a little like a high school science lab, with its rows of long workbenches and small glass bottles of chemicals. On one table, she's laid out 12 black and white photocopies in a checkerboard pattern. It forms a reproduction of the historic Waldseemüller map.
The baptismal map, or the christening of our continent. This is incredibly exciting.
The 4.5 by 8 foot map is a woodblock print decorated with Latin script and with pictures of elephants over unexplored Africa. Think Hollywood pirate movie, and you'll get the idea.
That the paper is in such extraordinarily good condition. It was a gentleman by the name of Johann Schoner, who was an astronomer geographer of the time, mounted it into a book. We certainly should be grateful that he did so, because it offered it such wonderful protection.
Well, it says these islands were discovered by Columbus.
The library's chief maps curator, John Hebert, says it was Waldseemüller himself who christened the newly mapped continent. He coined the name America in tribute to explorer Amerigo Vespucci. Vespucci reached the New World after Columbus, but it was his descriptions of his journeys that helped capture Europe's imagination. Vespucci was the first person to pronounce this unknown land to be an entirely separate continent.
And Vespucci had the great ability to be a great writer, or at least his writings would get in press. He had written letters back to Italy. His letters were then printed and were then spread throughout Europe.
Vespucci wrote about what he knew, which wasn't very much. Explorers hadn't reached very far beyond America's eastern edge, so Waldseemüller drew America as a winding salamander-like mass, and over it he wrote the phrase terra ultra incognita, the edge of what we know. So the Waldseemüller map wasn't accurate, but it was revolutionary. Just imagine the sudden appearance of a whole new continent.
Up to this point in time, the world, as we conceive of Europe, Asia, and Africa, thought of the world as its central focus. You know, we're now striking at authority. We're now striking at canons, because up to this point in time, it was understood the world was set. What happens when this new area, completely unknown, emerges to them? And of course, in this case, Ptolemy, the great authority up to that point in time for over 500 years, slides off into the ocean as the new map makers, the Waldseemüllers forward, begin to show what the world really looked like. It's an incredible change taking place on this particular map.
Copies of the map found their way across Europe. Waldseemüller had made 1,000 prints. Soon maps became a kind of status symbol. His maps hung in aristocratic homes as a sign of their owner's worldliness. Map conservator Heather Wanzer.
Waldseemüller's intention was that it would be displayed as a wall map. He even referenced the fact that a lot of people probably did not have the space to accommodate it, and he recognized that its large size was going to be a problem for a lot of people.
Maps also indicated a kind of pride in ownership. Explorers were roaming the globe, looking to claim undiscovered lands for their monarchs. A person could point to one of the royal crests scattered across the map and say, this land belongs to our empire. This is now a part of who we are.
As early as we can tell, maps begin by staking out someone's property. And the very first map we have is a small clay tablet from the Tigris-Euphrates, which shows land ownership along the Tigris-Euphrates River. That is my property, that's not yours.
In the 21st century, there are no undiscovered continents to claim. Our planet has been exhaustively and precisely mapped by satellites. But as in 1507, our view of the world will change.
We'll have an earthquake, we'll have a volcano, or we'll lose a structure or two, in as we've done recently, and that changes the face of the earth that, as we know it and humans' activities on it. As a boy from Louisiana, the Mississippi River doesn't listen to people who make maps. It always waits for the next flood to change its boundaries and locations, and maps are necessary to record where was the boundary.
All maps become outdated, Hebert says, and that's why we need to preserve them as a record of a moment in time and of a bygone world. For Studio 360, I'm Andrea Murray.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking with the historian Simon Schama, who is the author, among other books, of A History of Britain. And we're talking about maps. Simon, have you seen the Waldseemüller map?
Yes, it was displayed at an exhibition called Circa 1492. The Waldseemüller map arrived at the moment when, instead of just telling stories, and instead of having always Jerusalem at the center, and just having Europe, Asia, Africa, or, for example, imagining the world in terms of weather, instead of all that, you had a notion that you could divide the world into geometric slices, which became longitude and latitude. That if we understood math, we would now be able to understand not just architecture or astronomy or the cunning mechanics of the human body. We'd actually be able to trap space and it become usable and profitable and not scary. But that never quite happened. And if you actually look at the Waldseemüller map, one of the things you notice, because your eye, I'm sure you know, have seen it, is how amazingly wrong they got. It may have got a bit of America, but fantastically wrong about India, which is just this sort of bubblegum blob, really, in the middle. Then there's a bit of China, and we're fine at islands. And the person said in the report, really, it tells you a lot about who made them. Islands were places we were allowed to be, and huge, great Oriental empires we were not allowed to be. So that maps acted as a kind of, the trap was that we could nail down space. It could be possessed and therefore made tame. But the lure of people who was really to always get lost. And we do like getting lost up to a point.
And do those fantastic maps and those sort of artfully embellished maps, are they now entirely figures of history and things of the past, given GPS positioning and satellite mapping and all that?
Do you know, I'm not sure, but it is true, don't you think, that the Rand McNally world is different from the Waldseemüller world, actually, that we use maps like that very functionally to get from A to B. I was always astonished as a young lad flying over America in the 60s that nobody seemed to want to look out the window unless you were told to by the captain. They don't actually tell you anymore because guess what? Over there is the Grand Canyon. But there were fantastic things to see, the Great Lakes, even, you know, mysterious circles appearing in Nebraska, which still actually rather freaked me out. I know it's all to do with irrigation and boring things like that. And actually what you get now, don't you, are those non-map maps that tell you where the plane is and what the wind speed is and how far you've got to go before you can get off. And it's understandable to have that information. That is kind of visual database of space, the ultimate way to kind of pin down without any worry about traveling. So I think the kind of real poetry of mapping is very rare commodity. I think it may be, I don't know, do they have maps on trains anymore? I used to have those when I was a kid, and they were wonderful because you could just look out the window.
But I think you've hit on something, and that view of the Earth from 30,000 or 40,000 feet, let alone the view of the Earth that we started getting as children from space, kind of mooted maps in a way. Suddenly we're seeing the continents and the seas as they exist, and we don't need the sort of stylized representation of maps as much anymore.
I guess. I mean, actually, the great satellite photo, that I think is a poetic image in a way, not because it triggers the imagination to embrace the unknown, but because it did something that we really hadn't thought about it. No image gave us a sense of our fragility.
That whole Earth idea.
The whole Earth idea. And the cloud formations were the kind of special piece of action painting. So that image is very beautiful and very moving, I think, actually. Because actually it isn't simply contour in a kind of crude, linear way. And it just does look like the most delicately ephemeral dome of pleasure, you know, dome of wonder, sort of all of Shelley comes rolling back there.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360, talking with my guest today, the historian Simon Schama, and we're talking about maps and the imagination. There's a new novel called The Nautical Chart that uses a very old map of the Mediterranean to drive both its plot and a lot of its metaphors. The author, a man named Arturo Perez Reverte, has a penchant in many of his wonderful novels for leading readers through murky, intricate subcultures. In The Nautical Chart, a sailor and a rich museum curator hunt for a sunken ship, depending on a 17th century sea atlas which has the answers they need, but not in the way they thought. I asked Perez Reverte, through a translator, to read the epigraph he chose to begin the novel.
Una carta nautica,
a nautical chart is much more than an indispensable instrument for getting from one place to another. It is an engraving, a page of history, at times a novel of adventure.
Now, tell me about that quote from Jacques Dupuy. Did you know of it before you started the book, or is this something you came across as you were writing?
No, son los azares que tiene la escritura de un libro.
They're part of the random nature of writing a book.
Uno tiene algo en la cabeza.
You have something in your mind.
Tiempo,
you work on that for a long time, many weeks, many months. And there are things that during that period of time you read, you live through, and you run into that dovetail perfectly with the novel that you are working on.
La novela estaba casi terminada.
The novel was practically finished. And one day, while in Paris, I read an interview with a French sailor. And that interview quoted him as saying this epigraph.
Y dije, diablos, este tipo ha resumido en cuatro líneas lo que yo he necesitado 500 páginas para escribir.
And I said, oh my God, this guy summed up in four lines what I needed 500 pages to write. So I decided to use it as the epigraph for the novel.
You've talked just now about the wandering quality, essentially, of writing a work of fiction. It is certainly a journey with no map.
Sí, cualquier obra de ficción es ponerte a navegar.
Yes, any work of fiction involves setting sail. In reality, a nautical chart is a good example of life. The only difference is that there are nautical charts at sea, and there are no such nautical charts in life.
Now, the map is entirely fictional, right? There is no such person as your map maker, Urrutia Salcedo.
No, no existe.
No. He doesn't exist.
Una de las cosas divertidas de la ficción,
one of the enjoyable aspects of fiction, at least the way that I work on it, is to play tricks with history.
Es utilizar un material histórico, un material
it is to take historical material, concrete material, real material, you know, get very rigorous documentation on this. And within this rigorously true historical material, you try to introduce certain manipulation.
De manera que el aspecto general sea rigurosamente auténtico.
In such a way that the general aspect is rigorously authentic.
Pero dentro está el juego y la trampa.
But
es
within,
como modificar
you
la
have
de la Joconda,
play with the reader and
una lágrima
the tricks.
Eso es divertido.
It's like modifying the smile on the Mona Lisa or introducing a tear on one of her eyes. That's fun.
In the novel, you mention the real-life Jesuit priest from the 16th and 17th century, Matteo Ricci, who famously went to China 400 years ago. And among the other things he did to evangelize the Chinese was to teach them cartography and to show them the maps of the world as Europe knew it. Does that strike you, as it did me, as I was reminded of the Ricci story reading your book, that map making and cartography can be at the center of civilizations meeting and cultures meeting.
Y volviendo a la cita que hemos
I've been a sailor since I was very young. And afterwards, I was a reporter for many years in Africa and the Middle East.
Y para mí el mapa, desde los mapas topográficos militares.
And for me, maps, starting with the military topographical maps, including the nautical charts, all these maps have been a special source of fascination and enchantment for me.
Cada línea, cada camino,
every line, every path, every geographical accident were an adventure, an enigma, a discovery. The problem is that there are some places where maps are useless, where the labyrinth is in man's heart, and man has to run the risk of venturing into those mysterious worlds blind. Sometimes we forget that, but they're there. And in my novels, I attempt to continually remind the reader of this fact.
Todos los héroes de mis novelas saben
all the heroes of my novels know that mystery and danger are omnipresent.
And your heroes also are universally obsessed with these ancient valuable documents that seem to provide the key or a partial key to whatever their particular quest is.
Mis héroes son héroes que han perdido la inocencia.
My heroes are heroes who have lost their innocence.
Palabras como honor, patria,
words like honor, the homeland, everlasting love, religion, are no longer written with capital letters.
Pero a cambio de esa pérdida han conseguido la lucidez.
But
son héroes lúcidos.
In exchange for that loss, these characters have acquired lucidity. They are lucid heroes.
Entonces esos héroes lúcidos,
so these lucid heroes, in order to live in the present, understand that any key to the present is in the past.
Los mapas
maps are as suggestive and enigmatic as a book or a portrait.
Ante un mapa antiguo, pienso siempre en los hombres que lo trazaron.
The face of an old map. When I see an old map, I think about the men who drew it and the men who used it to move through the world, and the map which helped them meet other men. I think about the people who died en route without ever reaching their goal.
Yo soy un lector y un escritor del mundo en el que vivo.
I'm a reader and writer of the world I live in.
Todo ha sido escrito ya desde Homero. Todo ha sido compuesto ya.
Everything has been written since Homer. Everything has already been composed musically, and everything has already been painted. Every map has been plotted by satellite down to the last meter. Apparently, there are no longer any mysteries, no longer any enigma. Apparently, there's nothing new to be discovered. But if you carefully look backwards,
descubrir que la aventura sigue siendo posible, que el enigma está ahí,
you can discover that adventure is still possible, that enigma is there. Knowing that you're not innocent and making sure that all of that appears in your novels.
Thank you very much, Arturo Perez Reverte, for joining us today in Studio 360.
Muchas gracias.
Thank you so much.
Novelist Arturo Perez Reverte with translation by Daniel Scher. Perez Reverte's latest book is called The Nautical Chart. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the cultural historian Simon Schama, talking about the ways that maps relate to culture and to the imagination. In a minute, we'll hear how one artist tries to capture the sounds that reveal, if only to your subconscious, where you are. So stay here with us in Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with Simon Schama, author of many wonderful books, including The History of Britain, so far up to that important year of 1776. We're examining today the need that humans seem to have to map things, continents, fictional landscapes, personal history, even ideas. Why do we need to visually distill the structure of things? Andra McCartney is an artist who maps her world with sound rather than with lines or images. We asked her to take us through some of what she's discovered on her sound walks.
When you're looking at a park, you can look around and frame things. You know, you frame a particular view and then turn and frame a different view and block out the original view. Whereas a blind man standing in the same park, or somebody with their eyes closed, as sounds happen, the world sort of comes into being from that location. I wanted to come up with a creative project that was very, very much a daily experience. And so I sort of decided that I would record from the end of my street to my house every once in a while. So I rolled dice to decide when exactly I would do these walks. And as a result, did 26 walks over the year. Looking back at St. Clair, it's January 27th. It's about 5:30, just after sunset. Lights just came on, not long ago. At the very least, the project would be, at the end of the time, would allow me to sort of reflect on the sounds of my neighborhood. And at that point, I thought that it would just be one neighborhood that I was paying attention to. I didn't really expect it. I was invited to apply for this job, and I got it. We moved. It was the first week of July. It seemed like a sane thing to do, to continue making these recordings. And this is the side of the pier closer to 34th Avenue. Once I started to compare two different locations, I also started to think about other places as well, wanting to go beyond these two, because I think there's a lot about where I have moved to that's also quite reminiscent of my birthplace. I think it rarely reaches the conscious level. I mean, it was kind of surprising to me that it had never occurred to me that what the sounds of my birthplace were like until I started doing this project. That I hadn't really ever consciously thought, oh yeah, I live near the beach. It was an industrial resort with fishing vessels. I think it is part of what drew me here. I mean, it's not only close to water, it also has a harbor with small boats and a lighthouse and definitely the seabirds. It was a geologist, who discovered that homing pigeons, in order to find their way home from whatever remote location they're in, will use sound. And so they're listening, apparently, to the sounds of waves crashing against the shore, which make different sounds in different places, depending on the topography of the place and on the shape of the earth. They are using those sounds as a way of guiding themselves through a landscape so that they can find their way home. People do have intense emotional reactions to sounds that remind them in some way of home, that have a kind of emotional resonance for people. And I think that perhaps part of the reason that I'm interested in place is that I'm struggling to redefine my relationship to place.
In December, Andra McCartney will present a sound installation that she calls Homing Ears at the Art Institute of Chicago. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 with the historian and cultural polymath Simon Schama. We're looking at the cultural meanings of maps. You seem to enjoy that soundscape piece, Simon.
Oh, I loved it. It's I thought it was sort of like you know, the oral version of Proust's Madeleine. I mean, she was quite right that it's really childhood and places one has nested like a pigeon or something. And she's right that soundscapes have can trigger enormous power. I think actually what I really admire about her, she's trying to kind of liberate the sound of waves, for example, from New Age tepid bath music, you know, where actually music to fall asleep by. No, this is, you know, this is sound actually to have you all tingling and trembling by. I mean, really experience memory actually in a very direct and unmediated way. But actually, it's not like mapping in a way. It is because actually you kind of leap decades of your own kind of wanderings, you know, back to something. I mean, I grew up by the sea as a kid, so I remember a particular kind of rather thuggish seagull that used to hover around the mud flats of the Thames estuary. So,
no, the my Madeleine in that sense, having grown up in the middle of the country in Nebraska, is the train whistle, which
right.
I guess is a kind of, especially in the American collective mental soundscape, a powerful sort of trigger.
Of what do you think? Because it is very beautiful, but it's
of this simultaneous mournfulness and sense of travel. I can get out of this place,
yeah,
and somebody is going out of this place right now.
Yeah, doesn't happen anywhere else. That train whistle, as far as I know, certainly didn't happen in Britain. You had a kind of, you know, sort of Tommy the Tank Engine, rather annoyed, irritating little peep. But this fantastic sort of rather organ-like drone is rather beautiful, actually, hobo music.
I also thought, listening to the story about soundscapes and the sense in which they are or are not maps, and it's interesting, before film, certainly, before the novel, before any of these means of distilling reality into a sort of manageable little simulation, maps sort of did that, really. I mean, were maps the first artifact of culture that did that?
Well, I think, you know, people come back with bits of strange rock and what they claim to be, and sometimes was, a narwhal's beak, tusk, whatever, you know. And you could buy it for your Chamber of Curiosities, really. The Dutch were very into that, you know. Little tiny country, maybe a little claustrophobic, were fantastic armchair travellers. And you could go to the butter market and then you could see an elephant on display, you know, alongside the cheeses. And they were the first huge middle-class map buyers who would frame them and put them on the wall as well as put them in drawers. And I think they were objects of wonder. You could say, oh, clever us, you know, we have Indonesia, you know, the East Indies are ours and Suriname is ours. But I don't think that
New
was
York it. Is ours.
or Amsterdam,
I'm sorry.
For the time being. But actually, I think much more often they would actually examine them and revisit them as some
home entertainment.
Absolutely, dream images. And these were certainly pleasure objects. They were objects for the imagination, not for mathematical calculation.
We've talked before about the sort of blurry edge between a certain kind of painterly landscape and maps. How has the landscape in the mind of the artist, the painter, changed in the last 100 years? The landscape has become a less legitimate subject for painters, has it not?
Well, for painters, yes, but not for artists. I mean, that's to say, there was a time, Albert Bierstadt, who would take you to the top of some extraordinary gorge, or the Hudson Valley painters, and they would see that God had given you this fantastic sunset and all the land that was bathed in the rosy hue of the golden glow of 5 o'clock. And it was yours, America. It was God's garden. And as long as you were good, it would be yours as far as the eye could see and as far as your children's children's children could imagine. And Bierstadt's paintings got bigger and bigger and bigger, and they got very, very tall when he started to do sequoias, because how do you paint a sequoia without it looking small? But then, really, at some point, the notion that you would be exhilarated by trapping a piece of space, no matter how gorgeously it was lit, on a two-dimensional piece of canvas became hopeless. But now what's happened, I think, in not a politically correct way, is that artists are coming back and trying to work with pieces of nature themselves, and burnt wood, James Turrell in Roden Crater, for example.
He's the artist who's doing this incredibly large-scale earthwork in the Southwest.
Right. That's right. And using what's there, in other words, the artist for the first time is effacing himself, or him or herself. They're trying to actually present slices of the earth for our meditation, you know, and anxiety a bit, actually, I think, as well. I mean, all beauty, don't you think, presupposes loss, in a way? And
because it's not going to last forever, we love it for the moments we have it?
I think so. That's why, you know, very chilly marble Greek statues, to me anyway, are much less beautiful than the wrinkles that start to appear in the face of someone you love.
Because they're not evanescent.
Right. Exactly. So I think that's true of the earth as well. I think that's true of maps. Somebody speaking in one of your early pieces was right. Maps aren't permanent pieces of data, and that's one of the reasons I think we love them.
Simon Sharma, thank you so much for joining me today in Studio 360.
Thanks for your hospitality. Try not to get lost.
Simon Sharma is the author of Landscape and Memory, Rembrandt's Eyes, and other books about art, culture, and history. His most recent book and television series is A History of Britain, Volume 2, The Wars of the British, 1603 to 1776. You can find out more about his work and about everything else we've talked about today on our website, studio360.org. And to close our show today, we track down two artists who map their own bodies. Bill Outcult and Lila Locurdo use cartographic software to manipulate their images. Judith Kampfner met them in their New York studio.
For 10 years, Lila Locurdo and Bill Outcult worked together, mostly on sculpture, in a cozy Brooklyn studio. And then more and more the idea of a body in space intrigued them. And so they designed an adventure to work out how to reconfigure the body as a whole entity so that you can see all of it at one time flattened out. Their experiment took them to a military base and a clunky machine. Was it like a hologram, says I. No, says Bill, not that high-tech.
Yes and no, kind of spacey, but Buck Rogers-y, you know, like old-fashioned kind of Buck Rogers thing, you know, but you stand on a big round stage and then there's four heads that drop down tracks.
Why does the army use it?
They use it for measuring soldiers and working on body armor.
So you stood in this thing and it clicked and whirred and it took the photos.
It just goes zip, and in 17 seconds of when they start, your image is on a screen and they can just twirl you around like a rag doll.
When you say you see your body, do you see the internal organs?
No, you're hollow. So if you took the body and rotated it, you could look straight through yourself. But you're hollow. You're like a noodle.
So taking that noodle and squashing it is the next step. Maybe it's more tangible to think of a piece of fruit.
You have a whole orange, and then you peel the surface off, and you keep peeling it as if it's one. And if it doesn't break on you, then you have this long strand that you can put back together and make a whole. But apart, you have a long, curly strand that you might not identify as an orange.
Is it that stretched-out idea that particularly appeals, like pushing it and distorting it and stretching it?
That's an interesting question in the sense that we don't really think of maps that way, but that's what maps are doing as well. They are distorting. They're distorting in many senses. They can distort politically. They can distort socially. We knew that the body would do the same thing.
When you try to flatten the earth on a piece of paper, the shapes are twisted. When you open out a cylindrical image of a body, you tear it. Some visitors find the work violent because of the ripped skin and the holes. Lila and Bill are clinical about their bodies. There's no artistic touching up. Once they've picked the type of map projection to use, they don't fool with it. They're not vain, but then the end product is hardly a self-portrait.
It focuses on my breast and stomach and pubic area. And my hands, as you notice, are really big. And my breasts become tiny dangling things. I look very fat here. No, I like this piece because it's very Renaissance to me.
There's a beauty about the sepia colors, and the void area looks almost mystical, like vapor and clouds. There are black islands of hair, and a knee here is a volcano, and a space there between hip and foot, a lake. The artists, they find the human body miraculous. They say their work suggests the vulnerability of humankind. When you see a body with a flattened face, ripped back, and baby's feet, you see tenderness, and there's a sense of mystery as you figure out the puzzle. What is what I think of as a volcano at the bottom of that? What is it made up of?
That'd be my foot. But you're looking at it from the end, or from the bottom, and because we're hollow, you're looking like down my leg. The perspective is totally whacked.
For Studio 360. I'm Judith Kampfner.
You can see some of Bill Outcault and Lila Locurto's body map images by going to our website, studio360.org. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC along with PRI, Public Radio International. The production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Jocelyn Gonzalez,
Steve Nelson,
Michelle Siegel,
Lital Mulad,
Andy Lancet,
Amy Jeffries,
Lou Olkowski.
The music is by David Van Tegum. I'm Kurt Anderson, and I do hope you'll join us next week here in Studio 360.
Studio 360 is co-produced by WNYC Radio and Public Radio International and is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, the David B. Gold Foundation, and the Wallace Reader's Digest Funds, supporting education, the arts, and culture to enrich community life. Additional funding comes from this and other PRI stations nationwide.
PRI. Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360...
Comics just offer something you can't get anywhere else.
Art Spiegelman.
A kind of abstract way of telling a story. Every individual should have his own universe. It's an intensity in your head that it's hard to match from even pure prose.
I'm Kurt Anderson, the art of comics. Next time in Studio 360, where art and real life collide. From PRI.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.